Welcome back to TRP.
Hi, and a warm welcome back to the Rosnair podcast. Today we listen in to Claire Daly and Mick Wallace as they talk with Damien about the climate conference in Glasgow.
Hello to our listeners. We are in Strasbourg. This is IFRC Trouble with...
Damien's back! Damien. He's so excited, I know. Killed Bethany, and he's banished Kira back to Galway.
I have to say, the two
bullied
of them
his way back.
Did an outstanding job. They really, really good. They make me look really bad.
They were afraid to come again after you threatened his home.
What?
Yeah, they're cowering in fear. Yeah, he's bullied his way back. Here he is, fresh from Glasgow. He hasn't got a Scottish accent.
Fresh from a two-week holiday in Glasgow.
Where he learned to eat. Don't they eat deep-fried Mars bars there? Yeah. Did you have any?
No, but I am Scottish, though. My father's Scottish, so that's home.
Did you eat any haggis?
I had some veggie haggis, actually, in the cop venue.
Oh, veggie, fuck that now. The closest thing is a veggie haggis.
It was basically just mush, barley and mush or whatever. But in the cop venue, you go into the canteen area and there's all the Scottish parlour kind of area. And you go and you can get your haggis and your neeps and tatties, or you can get a veggie one. And it shows you the carbon footprint of the two, and one is significantly higher than the other. So
sounds horrific.
I had a horrible veggie haggis. I won't have it again. But I'm glad I tasted it.
Try the real thing the next time.
Anyway, I don't know if I could.
Now that Damien's back, we're going to stand the programme on its head for the start. So we're going to grill Damien, seeing as he was our man in the talks. I mean, Mick had been to the COP in Madrid.
It was supposed to be in Chile.
Yeah.
And then
I was looking forward to the protests. Yeah. But that was the reason that they actually changed it, because they didn't want... the world to arrive in Santiago and witnessing over a million people on the streets complaining about the neoliberal government, which is supported 100% by the EU and US, obviously.
Mm. Yeah.
So in any case, you got to Madrid, so you've a bit of an idea about the Jamboree. And I mean, we obviously on last week's programme talked a little bit about what went on in COP. I think Mick gave a very good analysis of that. But Damien, I think we'd like a feel for what it was like there. So we said we'd grill him for once.
We're going to pretend now that I actually stood down and he was my first reserve and he's the new MEP. So Damien Thompson, MEP for Ireland South.
They wouldn't have me in there.
Anyway,
be accepted.
How long were you there?
I was there for nearly 10 days. Wow. So I was there first on a mission of the left group in the European Parliament. So there was 8 MEPs and me and a few others that headed over there, because there's the counter COP that happens, the alternative COP, which happens almost at every COP. And it's just a load of different events. It's a summit. And then there's a huge demonstration. There was a massive demonstration on the Saturday in the middle of the COP with 100,000 people walking in the rain in Glasgow.
100,000?
100,000. Massive. Absolutely massive thing. We had some really big protests before COVID on climate, but this was the biggest one I've been to anyway since, for years now. But,
I mean, obviously the majority of them were surely Scottish, were they?
Loads of people that were there for the conference were on the street. So there was, I think, over 40,000 people there for the conference. And there are all sorts of people, delegates, but also civil society people, people from NGOs, people from think tanks, people from all sorts of actors.
Okay, as a matter of interest, what percentage of the 100,000 would you say were Scottish?
That's a complete stab in the dark. I'd say maybe 50%.
Yeah, well, that's good. Like 50,000 Scots go on the street protesting about climate change is good.
In the piss and rain, it was so cold. Yeah. Horrible.
I went to the conference
in November in Glasgow.
A bit like Dublin, like that way. Or any part of Ireland.
But it was a really great buzz, good turnout. So that was the first part of the mission. And then when they all went home, we had the official European Parliament delegation, which is what you did the last time, Mick, 2 years ago in Madrid, which is when we have one representative basically from each group in the European Parliament. And they do bilateral meetings the whole time at the COP. So they're in a room in the middle of the blue zone of the COP where all the negotiations are happening. And they're not actually negotiating the agreements that happen, but they're having loads of bilateral talks with other parties. So we're there to convince other parties about our position, what to do, our priorities, what we think they should move on, discussing the issues that are then being discussed in the negotiations in the closed room. So
I think you found that interesting when you were there.
And I miss, obviously, 2 years ago, there was no COP last year because of COVID. 2 years ago, I did find it really interesting in Madrid. I was there for a week and So I was picked as the number one for the group 2 years ago. So I was allowed to go to the meetings, and we sat down with the environment people from India, China, Russia, US, South Africa, and many other countries. It was really interesting, and being able to ask them questions, Brazil as well, in fact. It was really good to be able to challenge them and say, here, what's your position on this? What are you doing about this? What are you doing about that? But anyway, this year I wouldn't have got into the room because it was Petrus's turn, which is fair enough. So I didn't go because I didn't, you know, when I couldn't get into the meetings, I thought it'd be better to maybe hopefully get into the next time.
I suppose it gives you an insight into the challenges being faced by other countries and hearing things from their perspective. So I suppose, Damien, from your point of view, of those meetings that you got to go to this time, which were the most interesting two that had sort of information
absolutely
to offer?
And I've been to a few COPs now. It's the fourth COP I've been to. And the last one was 2 years ago, as Mick said. And it was interesting because we met some of the same heads for these meetings. So the Russian delegate was the same, the Chinese one. Loads of them were the same. So it's really interesting over time to hear what they're saying, what they're moving on, what they're proposing. But I think some of the most impressive meetings I had were probably with Bangladesh. I was really interested in what they were saying. It was completely, we hadn't met them before. It was the first time we met them as a delegation. They were extremely strong, very well prepared for going into these negotiations. They knew what they wanted. They had their proposal on the table. They said, EU, support us on this issue, on the loss and damage, on the finance. This is what we're demanding. Very clear, very strong. And they're at the very front line of climate change. They're a very low-lying country, highly densely populated, very poor as well. So they have the development challenge there. And they really served us on our asses on a plate.
So specifically, what were they looking for, and what was the response then of the EU to that?
Yeah, so they're part of this group. So there's all these kind of groupings. It's kind of like the way we work here as well in the Parliament. But at the UN level, in the UNFCCC, they work also in geopolitical groupings or different interest groupings. So they're part of a number of groups, but mainly the G77 in China, which is a group of over 135 countries, actually. And they're very strong in that about the whole emphasis on pushing on adaptation. So we're not just talking about reducing emissions, which is really important. Already in Bangladesh, they have a very, very low emissions rate per capita, as you can imagine, compared to other developed nations. But they're really pushing for more work to be done on adaptation. So that means getting prepared and ready for future climatic events and becoming resilient, basically, having a resilient society. So that's one of their big priorities. And then, of course, on climate finance, because as I heard you were talking about the last time, there was this $100 billion goal for dollars every year that was supposed to be met by 2020. It hasn't been met. And they went into our meeting and said, this is an absolute breach of trust. They were really unhappy about this. And that was said across the board from all the developing countries. They were not happy about this not being met. And it's not because the number is really important. It was the fact that a promise was made before the Paris Agreement and reaffirmed at the Paris Agreement that by 2020, this is the amount of money that we'd be giving towards developing countries for climate finance. And it hasn't been honoured. So they're obviously going into the room not with the moral high ground, and rightly so, because it was us who didn't deliver, and it was the US and Japan, and very late commitments as well coming in. And then on loss and damage, which you talked about in the last episode, which is a huge issue, it's not been talked about enough. When I'm following the media, there was a load of media about COP. I was really impressed, but there was very little focused on the whole loss and damage issue. And you spoke about it at the last podcast. And really, it's something we should be very ashamed of, I think, as people within Europe. We played a huge role in denying and slapping down the demands from developing countries, including Bangladesh. And Maldives was another country we met, which were really interesting. That would probably be my second one. They're a really low-lying country. They're only a metre, I think 1.8 metres is the highest point. So imagine what rising sea levels is going to do to that country. It's erosion. It's already completely a very highly populated country for its size. It's screwed, basically. So
just before you move on from your 100 billion, right? The 100 billion that was promised to the developing countries to deal with the challenges of climate change. I mean, I've read that some of the experts are saying now that it would actually cost, they probably need to come up, if they're serious about keeping it under 1.5, they probably need to come up with about not 100 billion, but a trillion. per annum. Yeah. What do you think of that?
Well, it's really hard to calculate climate costs and how much we need for all this. That's definitely fair to say. And like, it's a magic number. It's a nice round number, 100 billion. So is a trillion, actually, as well. They're all nice numbers. Now, there's different calculations and different demands. The African group were saying at this last COP that the post-2025 goal needs to be in the ballpark of 1.3 trillion. Now, that sounds like a lot of money, but actually, what just happened over the past 2 years, we had a COVID pandemic and a response that cost the globe around $15 trillion out of nowhere, basically. Mm. And we're able to materialise that. So there's all these issues about where we get finance from and whether this is too high, if it's achievable or not. What I think we need to do is look at adaptation needs and the costs for rapid reduction of emissions and calculate how much that is needed. Look at the developing countries, how much they're calculating for their own projects, for their own plans to reach their goals. And that should be our goal, do you know, for climate finance. We should be basing it on that and not just random, nicely picked numbers. But it definitely needs to be within the trillions. Like, if this is a climate emergency and we're talking about actually doing something within this critical decade, as they're now calling it, 2030 is the big decade to actually make sure we're not all fucked. Like, really, it's now or never, because we cannot just postpone action on all things and adaptation, loss and damage mitigation. It cannot happen later. It needs to happen now. The finance needs to come now, you know.
Right, but on the issue of the money then, right? I mean, you're saying, well, you know, they were able to come up with, was it 12 or 15 trillion to deal with COVID worldwide. And what happened with COVID, for example, right? The Americans and the British, right? They engaged in quantitative easing, which is printing money without a backup, right? And the Americans, one of the first things that the American government did when COVID started, the financial markets came under pressure. They pumped $4 trillion into the financial market. They literally gave it to big business to stop the markets from collapsing. Now, listen, it's a separate argument as to whether we agree with that or not. Right? Obviously, we'd have serious issues with it. But the point is, they did print the money and get it flowing somewhere in the system, right? Now, the EU has been very reluctant to go down the same path, and there's a reason for it. And that is that when you engage in quantitative easing, when you print money and you don't have a backup for it, what that does is it actually undermines the value of the money held by those who already have it. Mm. And if you're talking about the European Union, the country with the most money is Germany. Mm. The Germans have trillions stacked away. And if we print money without a backup and no clawback, no austerity, if we print it and get it into the system, the German money that they're storing and hoarding is worthless. So the Germans have prevented that sort of measure in Europe. But I mean, you're right. I mean, given that they were able to, that the some countries were able to actually print it for to deal with the pandemic, they could do it for climate change, which is actually a bigger problem for the world.
Well, the whole money tree thing that's always been said to be a big myth kind of turned out that there is a money tree in the end. And the COVID kind of showed that when there's political willingness, it's actually down to votes about where we get our money. And like, we can produce money when it's needed. So when we're talking about life or death situations with climate change, it's quite urgent that climate finance actually
flows. But isn't
that
the point, sort of like that, you know, with the pandemic and all of that, they kind of had to. So it was an emergency, but it was felt as an emergency. But I think with the climate debates, while they talk about a climate emergency, they behave in a manner which doesn't indicate that they actually believe it to be an emergency, because if they did, they would be putting the money precisely there. So I think that's the worrying thing, that they talk about emergency, but their actions are completely different. And no, I was just wondering, like, what was the feeling of the activists who were there? Was there a mood of demoralisation? Was it anger? Were they going to go, right, lads, we're going to have to really now ratchet it up? Or was it, oh my God, we're fucked? Or what was the sort of feeling?
Maybe a few things to say on that is the COP, and you'll know this, Mick, from being there before, it's a very weird sensation because a lot of the negotiations are behind closed doors, and half the time you're trying to figure out what the hell is happening and what are we at now, where's the update, where are we on this issue, because you actually, there's so little information being circulated sometimes. So there's activists there who are there with key messages on certain things, who aren't following exactly everything that's happening. There's a fuckload of lobbyists there from the fossil fuel industry and everything. And they were actually, if you look at them as a delegation, they were the biggest delegation that would have been there. Now, they came under different national delegations. And if you add them all up, they were they were bigger than any other delegation, which is just shocking. So, but activists, I think overall, there was a lot of different interest groups there, a lot of different interests, very, very, very varied. But overall, it was quite a big disappointment about it, because when you look at it on the grand picture, now I had my head in the place for 2 weeks, basically, and I was following things very closely, and I can see where there was progress, and I can see that there was actually a step in the right direction in terms of multilateralism. And I was kind of seeing different things there, that actually we've closed the rules on the rule book. We have an up and running and functioning Paris Agreement now. I think that's pretty good. Now, I'm not here to say that COP26 was a huge success, by no means, but activists are looking at it from the basic question of, did COP26 put us on a path for 1.5, or are we still doomed and on a completely destructive path of over 2 degrees? And on that question, they're absolutely right, because COP26 did not bring us down onto a path of warming that was in any way compliant with 1.5, nor did it do anything radical enough on adaptation or loss and damage. And what we're saying about the loss and damage issue is, a massive failure of COP was the fact that this Glasgow facility on loss and damage, which was the demand from G77 and China to create funding specific for loss and damage, wasn't established. And so activists who were working on that were extremely disappointed that they backed down on this issue. But it was because of complete intransigence from the EU and Switzerland and the UK, all these countries.
Well, I should add, in Madrid, I brought up loss and damage with the Russians, and they didn't want to know about it either. And that, because the Russians were involved in industry long before a lot of the people in the global south, even long before China as well. But the Russians didn't want to go to that space either. These countries, whether it's Russia, the US, the EU, they don't want to pay for the damage that they have caused. And they're only paying lip service to the problem until they actually accept that.
Yeah, and there's a few reasons for that. One is they don't want to pay more money. They don't want more taxpayers' money or anything like this going. But the other thing is the current global climate finance we have now, at least 70% of it is in the form of loans. So when we talk about this 100 billion thing here, it's not 100 billion of public money or taxpayers' money or anything. It's actually loans where they get the money back. So, but that doesn't work for things like adaptation. It's not profitable. It doesn't bring any returns, or for loss and damage, really. So they don't want to set up a new facility where they'd have to actually put money into, because once you do, you have to keep putting money into it, and it keeps going higher and higher, and they don't want that. And secondly, symbolically, if a fund is set up for loss and damage, so to be clear on what it is for everyone, it's about like rebuilding after extreme weather events or slow onset events, desertification, things like this, to be able to reconstruct after climate impacts. For having a separate fund just on that would be a huge admission of this historic responsibility, like you said, Mick. And that is just too much for these countries of the UK, the US in particular, but also the EU is completely toeing the line on this. So the EU would say, and you'll hear Frans Timmermans making a gut-wrenching speech about how much he cares about the Global South, that we're listening to you and you've said your plea and we're there and we're here with our highest ambition. But that's, you have to call bullshit on it, because behind the scenes, what they were negotiating, what they were saying was denying this facility to fund this, because they don't want to focus on historic emissions. They say they want to focus on emissions now. Fair play, okay. We should also focus on emissions now. But a key demand of over 130 countries is to deal with the current climate impacts that we're facing now. So,
okay, so my question to you then is, right, they have refused to go to that place where they have to do the right thing and engage with loss and damage in order to help the poorer countries deal with the challenges of climate change. So this is 2021. They're acting like as if we don't have an emergency. They're pretending that, you know what, it'll work itself out in time. Where's it going? When do you think, how bad do things have to get before they go to that space where they said, right, okay, you know what, we've no choice, we may do this, we may put up the money for loss and damage?
Well, the thing about it as well, it's about global justice, and it's about global capitalism as well. And like the developed world depends completely on the developing world for everything, for its wealth right now. So, and loss and damage is very much an issue of the developing countries. It's always going to be like that. Now, of course, the North experiences losses and damages too, but we also have a union civil protection mechanism here. So we have already a system in place. We have money. We can do things like this. As long as the South is experiencing climate impacts, like the EU is not going to sweep in there with money to fix things like this. And they don't want to have a facility where they're going to have to keep paying into and keep paying into. And what they keep saying is, we don't want to duplicate efforts. So there's other things out there. There's a UN World Food Programme. There's other humanitarian things. And these should be sweeping in for this. Or we should look into other innovative forms of finance and private finance for this kind of thing. But in terms of any kind of reparations, because it would be a form of reparations, we'll be paying up for the historical emissions for the current climate impacts now. They don't want to go. I don't think they will go there.
Never.
At the moment, the only bit of momentum now and why the G77 and China backed down in the end is because what was agreed at this COP was that there will be a dialogue on this issue, which is kicking the can down the line. But it means that this issue isn't going anywhere. So the next COP in Egypt and the one after that in the UAE is going to be an even bigger issue and an even bigger issue until it's settled. So the only way I can see it happening is if the COP essentially becomes completely and utterly drowned by this issue. Because if you ask people in Ireland, what's COP about? What's the Paris Agreement about? They'll say it's about reducing emissions, about 1.5 degrees. They won't say it's about adaptation, loss and damage. They don't hear that kind of thing. Mm. So until people actually hear about COP, loss and damage, COP, a Paris Agreement, loss and damage, then the EU won't feel under any pressure, I think, to...
It's a funny way. It kind of reminds me in some ways, I'm used to all the years of my political life, you deal with things like the Irish Health Service and you kind of say, given how seriously dysfunctional it is, why isn't there more people out on the streets demanding it to be changed when it's such a life and death issue? But it actually came to sort of saying, actually, people switch off on that because it seems to be so overwhelming that they feel they can't deal with it. And for me, the environmental crisis on a global scale is something similar. For a load of people, the scale of it seems too complicated, too big, too overwhelming. Oh my God, where do you start? Therefore, they kind of go, environment, climate change, switch off, good luck, too much to deal with. I can't take on board that responsibility. But in that context, then, I suppose, how do you deal with it? Because we have to deal with it. And then what I'm wondering is, we can't be accountable for all the hundreds of countries in the world. We have to start with the ones in our own and where we're based in the EU. And it's probably, or is it, fair to say that had the EU rolled in behind those other 100, that would have been a game changer.
Yeah.
In terms of clout politically and where the money is, and we have to focus a lot more on Europe.
I think that would have been an absolute game changer, because the EU expects movement on many things. They say we have the highest ambition. They pat themselves on the back going in there saying we are representing the highest ambition going into this COP. We have our climate law, we have our targets in law, we have our plan, we have our legislation. But if they went in there and actually said, okay, that's an interesting demand, let's work with that, let's see what we can do, they would have got movement on other things, do you know? And they drew this red line saying we're not getting this. And then they acted all horrified and shocked when there was weakening of language on fossil fuels, which was because India was pretty pissed off about the inequity there. So, do you know, like there wasn't any, the EU doesn't want to look at equitable solutions at the moment or looking at this. The whole basis of the UNFCCC is common but differentiated responsibilities. It's on equity principles about, it's supposed to be this thing of historical responsibility, about differentiated responsibilities, capacities to be able to react. The EU needs to actually properly acknowledge that and move where the demands are being made by developing countries. And actually, we were all very critical of the EU's climate law and its target and its 2050 climate neutrality target as well, because actually that isn't respecting these principles of equity. It's actually completely like an average of what we should be doing. It's if you look at it in terms of a global context, it's not at all enough for us to be able to globally reach climate neutrality by 2050. It's the EU actually saying, forget equity, forget fairness in the UNFCCC, forget about the developing world. We're going to set the target, which is what should be the global target, and we'll meet that. And that's their approach, you know, and that's, I think, a very shameful approach. And like you said, Claire, as well, I think Irish people, if they knew about what was happening, they would be outraged. They would be really angry, because it's very hard to follow everything that's happening there. And not because of just reporting, but there's also transparency issues. And there's a lot of doublespeak as well. There's I heard Eamon Ryan speaking at the COP, for example, saying how much he's listening to developing countries and he's going to be trying his best to work with this, whatever. And he goes in there, and I know he didn't challenge this position of the EU to actually work with the proposal that was on the table on loss and damage. Nothing happened there. There was no movement from the EU on this. And the decision in the end was, we'll do a dialogue on it and see what comes out of that. So,
well, I mean, talking about, I mean, I'm kind of struck by the fact that it really hasn't sunk in. We'll say, just take the people in Ireland, right? I would argue that the majority of people in Ireland don't see it as an emergency yet. And the reason they don't is they don't know people that died because of it, because of climate change, because they're dying in the double south. It's where it's hitting physically the most. And it's hitting there for a whole lot of reasons. I mean, aside from the fact that they're the ones getting the floods, they're getting the famines, the droughts. They're also the ones that have no money to deal with crisis when they arrive, whereas in the developed world, there is money to mitigate the problems in some form. So in actual fact, for people in the developed world, the notion that this is an emergency, that this is a life-saving matter, that there's millions of lives at risk, hasn't dawned on them, because they don't see it as it's not happening in their backyard. And we're happy enough to ignore what's happening in other people's backyard in the global south. Look, I mean, you raised the point, Eamon, about the fact that people might think that the developing world are dependent on the developed world. Well, and as you said, Damien, it's the other way around. The developed world, it keeps itself in the luxurious living that it does, thanks to the developing world, because we rob it blind every day. And Jason Hickel, in his book The Divide, pointed out that, and this was in a 2016 figure, that at that time, between loans and grants and aid, so-called aid, which always comes with strings, there was $2 trillion a year going from the developed world to Africa, but there was $5 trillion going back the other way. Yeah. We were robbing them of $3 trillion a year. So we are actually making sure that poverty remains dominant in the global south, because we want to rob their wealth and we want to give them very little for it. And we're okay with the fact that 4.6 billion people in the world today are living on less than $5 a day. We make it happen.
I think some of it is because the media in Europe and that as well peddle this line exactly as you've said. Well, we're doing our best. Actually, we're global leaders. And actually, when I was back in the Shannon there, when they had the Dublin MEPs in for a talk, I had raised the points roughly along the lines that you had made, Damien, about the limitations of the EU and their inadequacies of their climate response. But Francis Fitzgerald came in and said, oh, but we're the, okay, we could be better, but we are the very best in the world and we are leaders in this issue. Not taking into account that historically, obviously, Europe with colonialism and this, that is even more responsible than anybody else. And we have the resources to deal with it as well. But it's this sort of position, well, we're the best, therefore we've done our bit. Let the others catch up with us and then we'll talk to them, rather than actually we are the most responsible and we should deal with
it. It's a complete dereliction of responsibility on a global level, which was what we signed when we signed the UNFCCC and the Paris Agreement. We actually signed up to that equity and to that global nature of it and to be able to do more. And instead, what you'll hear is China's the biggest polluter.
Yeah.
China this, China needs to phase out coal, China whatever. China has the same GDP per person as probably Romania. Do you know, like, it is a big country, lots happening there, but like, come on, it's not the same power as the US and or the same emissions as the US and the EU at all. It has a huge development issue as well. It's brought a load of people out of poverty. It's been doing this as well with plans, and its climate target is only 10 years after the EU's. Do you know? So like, the EU is going on about its amazing plans, which are not even in any way more ambitious than they're supposed to be, like on global average. So. And then they're just saying that China's is the China. Trumpism.
It is a fact that China is responsible for huge emissions at the moment. But the people that throw rocks at China They do like to leave out those two items. They ignore where the historic responsibility comes from, which has been mostly the US and Europe. And they also ignore, when they talk about China, they compare it country by country, but they don't actually compare per head of population. And China has a population of 1.4 billion, which is more than four times the size of the US, for example.
Yeah, and we talk about, at the UN level, we talk about emissions on the basis of production. So as you all know, we've outsourced a lot of production as well. And China is the big manufacturing warehouse of the world, basically. 30% of goods come from China. They're made there. So we're buying...
For everybody else.
For everyone else. So we're buying all that stuff, causing all those emissions. Do you know, it's all embedded in there as well. And then they're not even counted in our own emissions. So the actual accounting system makes it look like we're actually fine. We're only 9% of emissions in the EU, even though we're the third biggest polluter. But we're completely within this system of very high consumption, way beyond planetary boundaries, with ways of living that are very carbon intensive. We eat way too much meat compared to what we should be for our own health and for the planet. And, you know, it's just unbelievable the way we talk about our own responsibility. And we talk about Ireland has this such small role and everything. But actually, Ireland is part of a very carbon intensive system as well. Do you know, we need to actually all transition.
I think that's the message we should register here, like, is that, you know, Ireland is a small country. The EU has 27 countries that actually, if the balance could be shifted there in a meaningful way, rowing in behind the other 133, that would be a game changer. And that's where we have to focus.
Yeah.
Because the, you know,
Well, Damien, just in relation to your 2 weeks in Glasgow, right? In terms of what's really happening in Ireland today with regard to addressing the challenges around climate change and how Ireland is dealing with them, in terms of the COP in Glasgow, how do you see Ireland's role?
So overall, with my own assessment of COP, I feel like it's always a bit mixed feelings coming out of it, because there's a lot of attention and momentum behind climate. But then it finishes and there's a bit of an anticlimax and you're like, what the hell happened there? And it always reminds me that in the end of the day, the COP is just about global consensus on a text and movement in certain areas. And what matters the most are real emissions reductions, which are done at national level and then regional, whatever. So I don't really care now so much about what Ireland was doing. I know it wasn't doing that much. It was because the EU represents all the member states. And I know Ireland really didn't put in that much work, to be honest, from what I picked up. But I'm interested more so in what Ireland's going to do now. So I'm glad they signed up to the methane pledge, for instance, which, even though I think it's a really poor pledge, it's only a 30% reduction by 2030, even though the UNEP, the environmental programme of the UN, says it should be 45%. I'm interested in how Ireland's going to honour that, because that's only a pledge. It's not in law anywhere. I want to see how they're going to deal with that. And that's leadership to me. If they actually come out of the COP and say, look, we're going to introduce law to make sure we reduce methane emissions by, I think they should contribute more to than this 30% goal. And if they do that, then I think that's a positive contribution. But I think all I know from Ireland's contribution at the COP is when I went up to Eamon Ryan and asked, and I heard his aide as well say, and they said they were listening to developing countries, and then they gave some crafty answer about how they're actually going to reject the loss and damage facility for funding. So I don't know what else Ireland was doing besides that, but I'm interested in what they do now, because that's what really matters.
Well, okay, well then, don't look at what Ireland's going to do now then, right? I mean, we had a very interesting discussion in the Environment Committee last week on the new proposed legislation on bringing in there's a legislative proposal being put forward which says that they will stop allowing six particular products onto the market in Europe if they have had any part in deforestation anywhere they came from, right? For example, soya is one of them. Coffee, there's palm oil, forget the other three now. Do you remember?
I need to look at the proposals.
Yeah, but anyway, one of the ones, obviously, I was thinking of the fact that Ireland imports 70% of its cereal because we have too much livestock on the island. And while we have shafted our own small family farms that used to grow grain, we're importing an inferior product from South America in particular. We imported 6.5 million tonnes in 2019 alone, which is a scary figure. But the idea that products coming from Latin America, the idea that it's not causing deforestation is a myth. Mm. Of course it's causing deforestation. Mm. So are we going to stop importing stuff that is linked to it? This legislative proposal says we will. Now, one omission on it was maize, which I found incredible. Mm. And I challenged the commissioner on it, but he refused to answer my question on it, because we're importing an awful lot of maize from Brazil in particular. And they are cutting down forests to grow it.
Yeah.
So in relation to Ireland's position, are we going to continue to import cereal feed from places like Brazil, who have to cut down forests to grow grain so that we can feed our animals, so that we can export dairy products to the Chinese and others? Is that going to continue? And is it sustainable?
Doesn't look like that's going to change in any way from this proposal, even, because the Irish government's plans for its agricultural sector are completely flying in the face of any sort of climate common sense. Do you know, like, so unless they get their act together in that respect, I don't think this one legislative proposal tackling a few products is going to do an awful lot. But it's also, we have the forests, the rainforests are really important to protect, but also soils. When we look at soils in Latin America, they're being completely degraded for corn production, soy production, even in places where they're not deforesting or that have been deforested a long time ago. And that actually has potential to sequester a lot of carbon, and it's a lot better for the environment and workers as well if we have a much more ecological approach to growing those products too. So I think that's obviously not a silver bullet. It's a good step, at least from the Commission, but it needs to do a lot more. Just one other thing on the COP I wanted to say is about some other contributions which you certainly haven't heard from, because there's no reporting on this kind of stuff. But Venezuela made a really interesting contribution in the last plenary session, just after John Kerry spoke for the US with a load of complete nonsense. And she made a plea, the delegate from Venezuela, saying about unilateral coercive measures, which are a term that we use for illegal sanctions. As you all know, Venezuela and others are under a load of sanctions. And she's asked the simple question of how are we supposed to adapt to climate change? How are we supposed to be ambitious on climate change if we're under a regime of sanctions? And she's trying to connect the dots here and say, like, what you're trying to ask us to be more ambitious here, trying to ask us to do more. We actually already are. Their position is supporting 1.5. They actually have a pretty incredible position for the horrible condition that they're put under. And then they're being denied finance. Being denied loss and damage stuff. And they're living under a regime of sanctions. And so they ask that simple question. Can you connect those dots there?
Yeah.
And like, honestly, if we're serious about climate change, that needs to be thrown into the picture as well. We need to talk about everything, do you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
So it's just one thing I wanted to bring up, because it's something you definitely haven't heard from the reporting back, but it was some interesting perspectives from the COP.
So look, I think we've actually, fair play, Damien. I mean, I think you've really actually made COP, which can be inaccessible to people, quite accessible. It is the planet's biggest emergency. It's the thing we should be spending most of our time on. And I think we have touched a lot of bases on that today. So I think that we should let our listeners absorb that. And it's something that we'll try and spend a bit more time to. We know it can be, don't like to use the word boring, but actually it is our biggest challenge. So we do need to be discussing it more.
And just to put things in perspective, I would say that there's thousands of more people dying from the impact of climate change than there are of COVID.
Well, more. And I mean, Irish people.
Thousands times more.
Yeah. No, totally. And I mean, and so, as there are people by the way our planet has been organised from poverty and all the rest and that as well. So, yeah, no, totally. So I do think people in the West understand the impact of climate change. We don't have the same seasons as we used to have and on, but we don't feel it in the way in which people in the global south do. So we need to get into that place.
Yeah, at the same time, we're extremely vulnerable. And we had a few little scares before, a few summers ago, where our whole agricultural sector nearly collapsed because of a hot summer. Nearly 30 degrees or something on Ireland, woohoo. But that nearly
collapsed
the whole
coastal erosion in Portrand. See, the houses falling into the sea. We're not that far away.
Livelihoods, and you know, climate change is about much as much about livelihoods as it about lives as well. And there's displacement issues. There's loads of stuff we need to go into.
I should just like to throw into the mix that in 4 months this year, in May, June, July, August in Italy. In Piemonte, there was 1/2 inch of rain in 4 months, and the wine crop was down 50% because of the lack of water.
Yeah.
Look, I think people do. People don't deny it now, but they don't feel it in the same way as the global south. But look, I mean, I think we have given good time to the topic. I think that's relevant. I think we will be back next week, and there have been a few requests in, and we're delighted with some of the feedback that we've got from people looking for some of the rule of law booklets, and they're on the way to the people who've been on to us. We also had a request for mixed book reviews, which we haven't done for a while. One of our listeners was on about that and suggested that we might cover and recommend a book which he says is one featured by Max Blumenthal, which he knows that Mick likes. And it's a book called The COVID Consensus, New Politics of Global Inequality by Toby Green. And seemingly it's a really good analysis of how the COVID crisis has been used to make the world more unequal. So people are looking for Christmas presents now, and you haven't had enough of COVID. COVID Consensus by Toby Green. Add that one to your list.
Well, just on the issue of COVID, right? I mean, we intend to do a serious bit on COVID in our next podcast. There's been a lot of reaction even to the bits we did already. And listen, there's an awful lot of things happening. We've engaged in an awful lot of debate, even within our own offices. There's 12 of us in total between the two offices, and there's a lot of disagreement about the way forward. There's a disagreement about what's really happening, but we're going to have to come up with a more coherent policy. We need to take a line on it, and we have to establish a strong position on it, because a lot of things are being left to be just dictated by mainstream media, which a lot of the time seem to have an
agenda.
And
we need to look
at
how that's presented, because I thought it was gas. I had my mother ringing in a panic to tell me about the riots in Brussels. We were there kind of going, what? And it was because of the manner in which sort of RTE was covering the issues. But there's been huge protests in Brussels, very, very significant numbers, tens of thousands of people against the new measures. Now, the new measures in Belgium aren't anything. Yeah. There's no real measures. They just said maybe people should consider working from home and that you have to wear your mask outside. That was about it. Like, they didn't change any opening hours or anything. So actually what it reflects is people have been totally disenchanted with the manner in which the system has been run. So look, we'll cover that in more detail next week for sure. And I think we'll feature our countries again, which we had left in the midair. And because Belgium had been up there, we'll include Belgium in next week's episode as well because of that. Great. So adios amigos. Enjoy the rest of your week.
Giudiamo.
I'd just like to thank Mick Wallace and Claire Daly for permission to use this material. Keep on listening to TRP.